Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is it, the final two acts of Faust Part 2. It's the surprisingly straightforward, if somewhat fragmented, acts 4 and 5 of Goethe's life's work. Will Faust be saved? Yes. Will Daniel and Claude applaud that fact? No. Will we get sidetracked with a disgusted and frustrated meditation on Faust's proto-fascist designs and how those designs can be seen at work in the contemporary American culture of this year of our Lord 2020? Damn straight. But we do get to take a look back at where we've been in the podcast and try to wrap our heads around what we can take away from Bloom's aristocratic age. Spoiler, Montaigne and Don Quixote. The Cannonball is a member of the Agora Podcast Network. If you like our show, check out some of the others on the roster, like 10 American Presidents. Join Royfield Brown as he explores the legacies and context of some of the more consequential occupiers of the White House. If you're online, check us out at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. Find us on Facebook at The Cannonball Podcast and on Twitter at Cannonball Pod. And if you enjoy the show, please rate and review wherever you listen.
Welcome to the Cannonball Podcast, attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me as always is Daniel Doherty. How you doing, Daniel?
Hey, pretty good. I embarrassed myself earlier today. I won't get into too much detail. Suffice to say, a sort of slapstick situation, which is exactly like one I experienced a week ago, happened. So what I'm saying is, I feel completely qualified to be telling the internet and the world at large all about literature right now, because I am a pretty smart dude.
Well, this is sort of us limping to our conclusion of a year of Faust. You know, we were talking about it off air, and I didn't even really realize we've been doing Faust in some iteration for about a year now.
Yeah, it's the Faustcast. Part of that year, of course, was taken up with a hiatus from when we were all just thrown into the psychic maelstrom of the early COVID lockdown situations and all that. You know, we put this on pause for a little bit. So, you know,
yeah,
not exactly a year, but it definitely has felt like a year of Faust. And you say limping to the end, and you know, I don't want to get people to turn off the podcast. But it does. Acts 4 and 5, which round out Goethe's life's work, Faust, parts 1 and 2. I guess as we talk about it, like, people understand what I mean, but like, after the sheer slap in the face bizarreness of like the Walpurgisnacht in part 1, the classical Walpurgisnacht, the reverie in you know, My City in Greece and stuff, the way it rounds out, I don't know.
It's a little funky. Yeah, it's a little weird. I mean, okay, so we were talking about this last time. I was sort of teasing you a little bit that, you know, how do you think it's going to end?
Yes.
And you were grasping for, you know, some kind of new iteration of the eternal feminine and, you know, some form of beauty that manifests itself that Faust strives towards. Nah, he becomes a real estate developer.
Yes.
That's sort of where this goes. Although, thematically, you can link it in, and I'll talk about that a little bit. I think David Luke, who did the translation, like the main translation that I'm using this time around, mm-hmm. Has some good ways of I think, bringing that together. But it takes a turn because I think you put it rightly. For all of the sort of wildness of everything that came before, it's really pretty tame by the end, except for the last moment.
Yeah.
Sort of the last two moments that lead us out of the play when Mephistopheles is grasping for Faust's soul. I mean, that is one of the most astoundingly ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, we'll get to it, but I always said that the only way that I think the only kind of visual media that I think captures the high seriousness mixed with the high campiness and the kind of whiplash tone would be something like True Blood.
Sure.
I don't know if you ever saw that on HBO, but
I didn't, but I do know it by reputation. Yeah.
And there are moments in that are so astoundingly bizarre and campy and serious and wild all at the same time that kind of capture what, you know, Mephistopheles' exit is really sort of like. And then it goes into sort of cosmic territory straight out of the Paradiso. That's yeah. sort of how it ends up. But before you get to that, it's really pretty kind of straightforward in an unnerving way. And yeah. I never thought that I would use that as a complaint.
It is, I think part of what kind of gave me the whiplash with it is that, you know, so this is all about, you know, the entire play, again, using the term play loosely, because I do not think anyone could stage this. I've actually laughed out loud at the very beginning of Act 4, the stage direction, mind you, says rugged serrated peaks, a cloud floats in and touches a peak, then settles on a projecting ledge. It then divides. No, this, you're not actually describing it. Anyway, those poor theater techs. But the whole play has been about Faust's desire, right? It's been about the drives of one, pretty venal drives of one man, and Mephistopheles just like, you know, heaping the, well, Faust is like Homer strapped into the ironic punishment department in hell, and Mephistopheles is the demon feeding him donuts until he's supposed to go crazy, right?
Right.
But of course, Faust never goes crazy. Well, you know, anyway, he sort of does. But so I keep thinking it's like, okay, like each one is raising the stakes, right? Like you had like, okay, you in Faust Part One, you basically seduce a young woman and leave her, you know, and then you raise the stakes from there to pulling off a gold scam on the emperor, on the Holy Roman Emperor. And then you up that with chasing the mythological paragon of feminine beauty. Where do you go from there? And it just goes back to scamming the emperor.
that's really – okay. So we're sort of dancing around it. But that really is the action of Act 4. And so tonight we're going to be covering Act 4 and 5. Act 4 – okay. Luke makes a convincing case that you can kind of break this up into – I'm sorry. It was Luke. I'm using two sources. I'm using the Norton translated by Walter Arndt and edited by Cyrus Hamlin. I'm using the notes from that, and I'm also using Luke's Oxford World Classics translation sort of for the translation and for some of the introductory material and the other notes. I believe it's Luke makes the case that you can view part two as two sort of like not exactly discrete parts, but interrelated parts. Mm-hmm. You've got the whole Helen thing from act one to three, and then you've got old Faust acts four and five.
Yeah.
And there are thematic links, like the way that I think the way that you can think of Goethe doing this is creating sort of motifs that wind back and forth. And that seems to me to be the best suggestion that there are these kinds of linking mechanisms throughout the text. The critique, and this has come up in sort of past episodes, the critique that I had of the Norton annotations is that too often it sort of assumes a continuity that I really don't think is there.
Yeah.
There's a kind of continuity. There's a kind of connection between the pieces altogether, between the acts or between the parts of Faust II. And there are thematic links back to Faust I, and certain kinds of ideas get reformulated and reworked and reprocessed. But, I mean, to try to view this as a kind of realistic drama or literal drama or something like that is it strikes me as futile, like a real misreading of the text itself. I think the text is, if it is linked, it's thematically linked and not realistically linked, if that makes any sense to any listener.
Okay. Yeah.
So what happens is the veil of Helen becomes this kind of cloud that whisks him away to back to Germany. And it always makes me think of, I mean, this is extraordinarily stupid, but the image I always get is, you know, in Super Mario Brothers, when you have those sort of like cloud monsters that are throwing the spiky things at you, and you jump on its head and pop it off, and then you get to ride on its cloud for a little bit.
Yes.
That's what I imagine Faust doing, is just kind of like hovering in this cloud.
As long as we're being stupid, of course, people who came home and watched the Toonami programming block on Cartoon Network in the late 90s might remember when Goku had his flying cloud on Dragon Ball.
There you go. It's kind of the same thing. But anyway, it sets him down in the mountains. And this is a moment that has certain kinds of resonances. It has a resonance with the beginning of Faust Part Two. Remember when Faust wakes up after the events of Faust Part One, and he's in that enchanted landscape, and he has that monologue that we sort of went over, you know, long ago when we were doing the beginning of Faust Part Two.
Yeah.
This is another sort of callback to that, and that monologue was also a callback to Faust's wank cave.
Yes.
Back in part one. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, go listen to our episode on the second part of, I think it was Faust Part One, Part Two.
Yes.
That's how we called it. Anyway, all of these things, they have a kind of thematic resonance, and they sort of like add up to these moments, these Faust soliloquies. And here he is being set back down in Germany, and he starts meditating on the sort of feminine sublime or the feminine ideal, which leads him onward. He sees it in the clouds, and it makes him think back to Gretchen. We haven't really touched on Gretchen or touched on anything that happened in Faust Part One throughout you know, this entire thing. And that's another one of the, I guess, the scandal of Faust Part 2 is that, you know, the really, really gut-wrenching stuff from Part 1 is just kind of ignored.
Yeah.
But this is Luke's translation. He says, "Yes, now my eye is not deceived. On softest bedding, sun gleam, splendid, there she lies, a woman's form, most godlike, giant-like indeed. I see it. It is like Juno, Leda, Helena. With what majestic charm it hovers in my sight." So he's looking up at the clouds and he's seeing a giant woman. He's got some kind of fetishistic something going on there. But that sort of becomes the emblem to him of this, you know, eternal feminine. And that, I think, is also to Goethe's point, like the, you know, Part One was really, really grounded in the specificities of that tragedy. And Part Two keeps going to these really sort of abstract, I mean, almost cartoonish places. And, you know, at the end, when Faust is called up to heaven, there's sort of a further meditation on this, but it seems as if Goethe is arguing that it's these broad archetypes or these broad forms which allow you to sort of see yourself in them or see the reality in them. So the particularities aren't as important as these other kinds of broad forms are. And the broad form is the thing that the artwork can do so that you can supply it with your own energy or with your own experience. I'm not explaining this as clearly as I could be under other circumstances, but I think you kind of get the idea. We talked about this a little bit before when we were doing Act One, and I was suggesting that there's this weird thing in there where where Faust or Goethe is publishing this after he's already dead, and there's this kind of animating spirit throughout. It's like the Goethe that is both there and not there, the Goethe that's the ghost of the machine. But the other part of the machine is the spectator. Yeah. And we come back again, I think, at the end to this idea that the spectator makes the spectacle. The spectacle is kind of like this broad abstract form. The spectator must provide it with the individual experience to make it real, right?
Oh, so we're dealing with a little bit of quantum superposition in dramaturgy.
Yeah, I think so. In a kind of way, yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so Faust keeps getting drawn to the abstract,
yeah.
But the abstract reminds him of the real. He says, "But round my breast and brow there hovers still so cool, so pleasing and caressing, a bright wisp of cloud. Now lightly, hesitantly, higher it ascends and shapes itself. Does joy delude, or do I see that first, that long-lost, dearest treasure of my youth?" That would be Gretchen. He seems to see Gretchen in the clouds. And he says that they rise to view those riches of my deepest heart that leapt so lightly in the early dawn of love, that first look quickly sensed and hardly understood. No precious jewel could have outshone it had I held it fast. O lovely growth, O spiritual form. He's still thinking of her to some capacity.
Yeah.
But it's not with that kind of regret and reverie, oh my God, what have I done? It's, oh man, she was beautiful. I still wish I could have her.
It's a really weird, like he abstracted the concrete. And
yeah.
even as the abstract reminds him of the concrete, he just re-abstracts it. Like it's not this actual woman who he deeply wronged. And you know, if I were writing the play, I would write the rest of the play about how do you live with yourself after doing that. but he turns it into just another kind of figment.
Yeah. So she's become a principle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And speaking of abstraction, Mephistopheles shows up in a giant boot.
Yes.
Okay, a pair of boots comes clomping up. It's the Seven League boots from the sort of fairy tale tradition. And Mephistopheles hops out. And they have this sort of conversation back and forth that's modeled on the temptation of Christ. Mm-hmm. And Mephistopheles keeps asking Faust, well, what do you want now? And Faust basically says, I want to control nature.
Yeah.
He's insulted by the chaotic, ever-moving ocean, and he says, I need to control that.
Yes. I thought it was very interesting that the objection that he raises is that, you know, here you have this raw elemental power of the sea, and it just crashes against the land again and again, but the land's still the same, though. It hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
He wants to harness, which, and again, which is also interesting that the, I picked up some notes of geological theory happening here, because there's also a kind of extended, Mephistopheles mentions things about, like, oh, you know, all these landforms are the results of what we demons got up to after the fall, like striking at things with sledgehammers and hurling rocks this way and that, you know, commoners retain this wisdom because anywhere you go, like, you, if anyone, there's an unusual rock, the locals will call it Devil's Rock or Devil's Bridge, yeah, etc. It's this kind of what's called a principle of geological theory, which was current in Goethe's day, called catastrophism, which that the landforms that we have are the results of huge upheaval calamities at some point in the past, you know, directed by God's hand or not. But there was not a kind of sense of any sort of what we might call a fluid process or a gradual process. Right. Of geological formation, which is why it was so funny to hear him talk about how, like, well, the sea beats against the land and nothing ever changes, when we actually know that, like, well, no, that's actually a huge driver of geological change is weathering by ocean on continental shelves. Like, that's, you know, but, you know, for Faust, though, it's just, he sees this, this enormous power unfocused and impotent to actually achieve anything.
Yeah, and so, all right, there are a couple of things going on here. So, remember when I said there were thematic links? Mm-hmm. This is a revisitation of the old Neptunian versus Vesuvian geological outlook.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This was the thing that came up in Act 2 in the Classical of Walpurgis Nacht, where, you know, the homunculus is caught between these two philosophers having a debate about whether or not change is gradual and deliberate over time,
yeah,
or whether it's sudden, rapid, and violent.
Yes. Right? Yes.
And Goethe's view was the Neptunian. He thought successful change, I mean, we talked about this a little bit, but it's basically his conservative outlook. Successful change, right, is slow. He was not in favor of any kind of revolution. I mean, he was an old aristocrat, more or less, and
right.
he did blame the aristocrats for the revolution. I mean, he sort of wound up saying, "Well, if your people turn against you and behead you, then it means you weren't a very good ruler." And
yeah, you
he's got a point.
Yeah, you weren't fulfilling your actual intended role as an aristocrat. You know, there's that. Lost the mandate of heaven.
Yeah, but he still assumes that should be your, you know, intentional role.
Right.
So anyway, it's his anti. There's a lot in Act 4 and 5 or Acts 4 and 5 that speak to his anti-revolutionary outlook. But there's another thing that's going on that Luke sort of notes. It's oblique and off to the side, but in the introduction to his translation, he notes that the sort of eternal feminine isn't really seen throughout most of Acts 4 and 5 until you get to the end, when it sort of comes up right at the very end.
Yeah.
But you could possibly read, if you take some of Goethe's contemporary writings into account, you could read nature itself as a version of the eternal feminine.
Yeah.
There are apparently some essays that Goethe had written where he categorizes nature as a kind of chaotic feminine that must be maintained and controlled and so on and so forth in this misogynistic way.
Yeah.
That seems to me a convincing read. And it would connect this all together with Goethe's drive in the old age for one more way of containing and controlling the eternal feminine and being sort of, I guess, motivated toward it. Mm-hmm. And it really does bring out the underlying misogyny of this text. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In any case, the dialogue with Mephistopheles is a parallel to Christ. Mephistopheles basically asks, or parallel to the temptation of Christ, and Mephistopheles asks, well, what now? What do you want? Faust wants to control the tides. And Mephistopheles says, well, first you're going to need some land to do it, and I know how to get that.
Yes. It's time to scam the emperor again.
So let's go back to the Holy Roman Emperor and pull another fast one on him.
Yep.
Essentially, the end result of the scam that they pulled the last time is that the emperor has lost power. His people are in revolt, and they've chosen the anti-emperor to wage war on this emperor. And so you've got the fight of the two emperors. Now, we never see any of this. And this is one of the funny things. Both of the texts that I've been consulting articulate that Goethe at various stages had written a whole lot of connective material and then took it out.
Yeah.
So, you know, we never see Faust descend to the underworld to get Helen in this sort of Orphic way. We never see the action in Act 4. We never see any of the sort of dramatic stuff that you would expect to see in a play.
Yeah.
We have it related to us.
Yes.
And yeah. It's so that, I mean, that seems deliberate frustration on Goethe's part, because apparently he was trying to get out from under a kind of narrative dramaturgy closer, trying to get, I guess, closer to something like symbolic or expressive opera.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that he's more like, you know, like, oh, well, you know, if you came here to watch a story be told, you know, there's, you can get that anywhere. I'm taking, you know, dramaturgy to strange new places.
Well, I can't remember if she spoke about this on air or not, but when I was talking to my friend Rachel, she was saying that part two really struck her as more like a pastiche, like it's extraordinarily mm-hmm. fragmented, and then he just throws in anything and everything that he wants to, and you know, it's almost like he outdid the postmodern pastiche before there was a postmodern pastiche. And
it wouldn't be the first time that we've read a work that anticipates so much of what people think, you know, they've invented in the 20th century with, like, or maybe not even think, but like that's what struck me about Don Quixote. So much is that it's such an intensely meta text through and
through. Oh Lord.
Yeah.
Well, but then, you know, he out-fragmented the wasteland.
Yeah.
Like Goethe was his own Ezra Pound. I don't know if you know, but Ezra Pound famously took out all of the connections that Eliot made in the wasteland. Ezra Pound and Eliot's wife, Vivian, was heavily involved in the editing of the original text of the wasteland. And she and Pound took out a whole bunch of stuff. And Goethe just took it out himself. So he out-fragmented the wasteland. But anyway, there's all this sort of fragmented stuff. But they decide to go hassle the emperor again. And apparently the end result of the hassling him the first time, the sort of fraud that they played on him, was to create instability in the empire. So there's this Napoleonic figure who's never on stage, but is a kind of counter emperor. Mm-hmm. I think critics read it as Napoleon in some way, shape, or form, who is behaving much the same way, just for different ideological purposes. But the practical results are essentially the same, is how the play kind of frames it.
Right.
So going in on the original emperor's side is something of an arbitrary gesture, And we're meant to believe that this emperor really is kind of weak and a poor ruler, because it was his own frivolousness which led to him being, you know, potentially deposed. But he is the old aristocrat with the greater land ties, so let's go ahead and support him. Goethe comes down on the side of the aristocracy when given the choice. So support him they do. To use magic and fraud one more time, Mephistopheles jumps into the fray and conjures the mighty men.
Yes.
Which I think is hysterical. Mephistopheles conjures these three great heroes who are translated as the mighty men. And they're sort of like these allegorical figures. Mm-hmm. And they're none too bright, but they are big and demonic and big, heavy, tough guys. And they get in there and kind of get the job done and rout the other side. And the suggestion is that this is all illusion one more time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a very – the mighty men were interesting in the – well, I mean, they're just rapacious. It's just this very – this very cynical view of warfare. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, because there's Bully, the youngest of the bunch, and Takehold, the mm-hmm. you know, the man after the loot, and oh gosh, what was the name of the last one, the keep holder? I don't remember if it was keep holder.
Yeah.
But you know, keeping what you've gained by your bullying and taking. This might be a stretch, but I was reminded of the early Republican legionary system mm-hmm. of Rome, which and this was a sort of an idealized version of it, but the idea was that when you were a young man, you served as a hestatus, a spear bearer, but you wouldn't actually carry a spear. You'd have a sword and a shield, but you'd be kind of the front lines. And behind them were the principes. You're a little older, a little more wizened. This is your prime years. You know, you're in your early 30s, and you were kind of there to hold be the bulk of everything. And all this was backed up by a line in the back of your most grizzled old veterans fighting in a kind of old hoplite style called the triarii. Who there's there mm. to kind of hold the line at the last pitch with, you know, the most hardened guys you have. Mm. And I feel like these three expressions of martial vehemence kind of echoed that it was called the Camillan Legion system, which was later replaced by the Marian Legions. But that kind of tripartite dividing of roles according to your age and experience. This is what kind of drew me to mind, because of course the old keep hold is there to hold everything down, you know.
Yeah.
Which got me in mind, like, oh wait, that sounds a little bit like the role that the Triarius was supposed to perform, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean that I wouldn't put it past him to be in his mind.
Yeah.
I mean, Goethe the classicist most likely knew a great deal about ancient warfare.
Yeah.
So that sounds about right to me. So they win through magic. They win through fraud.
Right.
They win through illusion, just like they got him out of debt through fraud.
Yes.
So we end that act in the rival emperor's tent. So in the tent of the counter emperor, basically, it starts out with a couple of the buddy men coming in trying to grab as much cash as they can from the tent.
with their camp follower assistant.
Yeah. So essentially, they're just trying to sort of, as you said, this is a deglamorization of warfare.
Yeah.
It's just spoils.
It's a smash and
grab. They're kicked out, and then we have the emperor basically ceding power to a bunch of princes, basically giving over lands and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. giving rewards for everything that was done. And it's an extraordinarily ironic and somewhat cynical scene where the princes are just as debauched as the emperor, and then the church gets the biggest share. And the church keeps coming back in and says, oh, by the way, because you use demonic shit to get here, we're going to need a bigger tithe. So, yeah. The Emperor wins, but it's an extraordinarily ironic win. And the whole thing is he gave Faust a huge chunk of land, and now he gets – like the Emperor basically gets nothing for having maintained emperorship.
Yeah.
So he actually kind of loses in the long run.
Yeah, yeah. But this not to make this all about parallels to the vast long history of Rome, but that's the – and I don't think this is necessarily was on Goethe's mind, because this was not the contemporary view of what happened with the fall of Rome. But that's very, very much what happened with the end of the Western Roman Empire, is that you had an increasingly weak imperial center that kept delegating defense duties to these armies of, you know, well-equipped and hardened barbarians who were roaming around. Mm-hmm. Like, rather than keep fighting them, like, hey, come over on my side, say that I'm your, you know, pledge fealty and loyalty to me, and then you can rule over Gaul however you want. Just defend it. And eventually they just make themselves obsolete.
Right, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
I would say it's kind of the same thing, except with the church thrown in for good measure.
Yes.
And so it's you know, yet another anti-clerical satire.
Yeah.
So that's how Goethe, or that's how Faust gets his land. And that brings us to Act Five. You see what I mean? Like, to any of our listeners, this is what we're talking about. This is surprisingly coherent.
Yeah.
It's nowhere near the kind of wild phantasmagoria of the earlier stuff. Well, at least until we get to the end.
Yeah, okay, it's coherent, but it's also kind of like perfunctory. Like, yeah. It's like, okay, and that's how Faust got his land. And then we jump ahead to what must be decades after this.
So, yeah, we jump way forward in time, and we jump to two characters who we've never seen before, and who we don't really see much of afterwards because they're dead. We have Bacchus and Philemon, or Philemon. Bacchus and Philemon. It's a story taken from Ovid's Metamorphoses. It's an old Greek story where a couple of the gods come down and they're judging humankind. I think in Ovid it's Jupiter and I wrote this down so I wouldn't have to remember. Jupiter and Mercury. And they come down to judge humankind. Basically, hey, if people are nice to us and they don't know we're gods, then we'll see what we can see. And if enough people are nice, then we'll spare humankind. And if everyone's a jerk to us, then we'll kill them all. Well, Bacchus and Philemon are this elderly couple who take in the wanderers and give them what little they have. And so Jupiter and Mercury say, well, they're the two good ones. We're going to spare them. Everyone else dies and they flood the world. Well, yeah. The flooding motif is going to come back up because Bacchus and Philemon they're this elderly couple who are taking up the last sort of the last little square of property that Faust wants in order to, I guess, finish his grand design.
Yes.
Which is really kind of obnoxious. We'll talk about that in a second. But they welcome in this wanderer who is, I believe, a sailor. And he wants to know about, you know, what all this is going on. And they give him the backstory. Apparently, Faust has been using Mephistopheles and his diabolical laborers to industrialize this section of land. I'm going to the notes that I was reading, the Norton and the Oxford. Both of them sort of point out that Goethe is a bit ambivalent about industrialization. Like, on the one hand, biographically, he was pretty pro, I guess, industrial project. Yeah. If it made things, I guess, more quote unquote efficient, then he was all for it. Like, he was sort of four canals that would link waterways, and mm-hmm. all about sort of cultivation and industrial cultivation. On the other hand, he was also aware of some of the drawbacks, the dehumanization that can go on, mm-hmm. as well as some of the ecological issues. And so it's a kind of back and forth. There's an ambivalence there. Faust is proud of his project, but it was all diabolical projects.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting too, the nature of, because, you know, the, you know, Goethe's writing during the kind of the transition from Enlightenment to Romanticism and kind of the wider cultural milieu. And I'm not enough of a cultural historian to speak with much authority on this, but one thing I do recall from reading about like this time is that there was a very distinct mode of what landscapes were to be admired at work in the Enlightenment. There was actually there at least in the French Enlightenment, and you find this reflected in the French garden, right? Because, you know, the sort of the great garden traditions, there's the French garden and the English garden. And the English garden is the one with like nice little wooded paths, and it's a little bit wild, and maybe there's a folly built to look like a tumble-down ruin there, and it's all very hobbitsy. Yeah. The French gardens are the ones you go to, and everything is geometric, right? It's these starkly geometric layouts on the like flat planes, flat frictionless planes, where you just use plants as vectors. And that's a carryover of this Enlightenment attitude, of course, which they were all about regularizing and systematizing, that saw basically flat, even ground as the ideal of beauty. And you would have people writing sniffingly about taking a trip on the carriage through the provinces and like, oh, those ugly, craggy mountains. You know, these kinds of landforms that we today think of as tourist attractions and like, you know, the height of natural beauty were kind of snubbed and disdained. And that kind of jumped out to me about Faust's particular landforming project, where he's using demonic labor to make a flat, featureless plain with a single like rod straight canal running through it. Yeah. It was a very like, oh, well, damn, okay.
So this is such a political cliche in our own time, but he's literally draining the swamp.
Yes.
I mean, that's his ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's right.
They give the backstory on all this, and there is this ambivalence in Faust's project. Mm-hmm. There seems to be an ambivalence in Faust. There seems to be an ambivalent, or there's not an ambivalence in Faust. There's an ambivalence in Goethe. So that this whole Act Five is really sort of darkly ironic.
Yes.
It's so darkly ironic that the question remains, well, why the hell is Faust saved? But that's, we'll get to that, I guess, when we get to that. So Faust is angry that someone dares to hold out, go buy him out, you know. And he tells Mephistopheles and the three mighty men, go chase these guys out of here. And I've already given them, you know, a great tract of land to sort of start over and do what have you. Why are they holding on to this nothing? And so Mephistopheles and the mighty men go and kill them, along with the wanderer who just kind of accidentally showed up there, and burn the whole thing down. Now, we don't see any of that. We have it told to us by Lynceus, the watchman, who just kind of shows up there. He seems to be, you know, he's one of the characters from, I believe, the classical Walpurgis Nacht. And I was wondering, like, he has a monologue where he basically describes the burning and he describes, you know, the calamity. I was curious. I couldn't sort of be satisfied in this curiosity, but I was curious if he's not drawn from the watchman in Agamemnon, because he kind of has that function. I don't know if you've ever read Agamemnon, but it really sort of begins with the watchman waiting for the signal to know that Troy has been taken. and he's been waiting there forever. And on the one hand, the signal that Troy has been taken would be a good sign that Agamemnon is on his way back and all of this nonsense is over. On the other hand, he has a particular inkling that when Agamemnon gets back, it's going to be bad. I don't know. Lynceus has that kind of function where he's watching, but what he watches is sort of, you know, the fire that occurs, and he's got this horrid description of these elderly people who are killed. And Faust is at first excited because, okay, they're old, they've been kicked out, their place is burned down, but I've got a great new place for them to live and everything will be fine. And then Mephistopheles comes in and says, yeah, we killed him. You know, we tried to get him out of there, but what are you going to do? So Faust gets mad. And this you claim to have done for me. I said, exchange, not robbery. Deaf savages, I curse this deed. Now share my curse, your folly's meed. They're like, what? What did we do? You told us to get rid of them. All right. So anyway, at midnight, four gray women in the form of cares and guilt and anxiety come to visit Faust, and they blind him. But, okay, again, Goethe really lays it on. It's maybe you could identify with Faust in part one. At certain points,
yeah,
right? Like, he does come across as somewhat tragic in certain moments. And in part two, maybe his quest to keep questing is in some ways heroic. But after having caused the death of, like, an elderly couple, he's blinded, but here's his heroism. Night seems to close upon me deeper still, but in my inmost soul, a bright light shines. I hasten to complete my great designs. My words alone can work my mastering will. Rise from your sleep, my servants, every man. Give visible success to my bold plan. Set to work now with shovel and with spade. I've marked it all out. Let it be made. With a well-ordered project and with hard toil, we shall win supreme reward. Until the edifice of this achievement stands, one mind shall move 1,000 hands. Faust is still heroic because you may have blinded me, but my inner soul pushes on and I will still strive. You can't not read that ironically, right?
Yeah.
He's still showing the same, I guess, disregard for others that he was showing in Faust Part 1. So Gretchen dies. Big deal. I'm still striving for the eternal feminine. You know, how are we supposed to take this? This is, I don't know, it's abominable. You know, it's really pretty monstrous.
Yeah, and that bit about one mind moving 1,000 hands also, like, it speaks to the, I don't know. And this is my own kind of, longtime listeners know my own political bent is toward the egalitarian, but like that kind of like equating that, you know, power with just the, you know, I can tell all these other people what to do and they'll do it. And therefore I did it.
Yeah.
It's just one of the most impotent things I can imagine. And I hate it every time. I hate it every time. There was this, I get so mad. I'm sorry. A short aside. I get so mad. At the library I work at, you know, we have a lot of documentary DVD sets, and there's one, apparently History Channel did a series a few years ago called The Men Who Built America.
And Jesus Christ.
And it's just biographies of the robber barons, like your Vanderbilt and your Carnegie and everything. And I just want to scream at them, no, these men murdered the people who built America in their mills. Like, please get your head on straight about this. I had to, just as an aside.
No, I mean, I think most historians, like, okay, you know, the railroads, I think in the early to mid 20th century were held up as this great American project by great American businessmen, but they were a tremendous boondoggle, and they were basically supported with public money. And whatever rewards were reaped by the idiot bastard sons of, you know, the already extraordinarily wealthy who basically sat around doing next to nothing.
Yep.
While other people did it before.
It was a bonanza made possible by ethnic cleansing by the military and big subsidy giveaways. Story of America, folks. Starting from way back.
Yeah. So anyway, that's exactly what's going on. And you can read Faust as fascist. I mean, we spoke about this before, that there's a way in which the Nazis did kind of draw on aspects of German romanticism and mm-hmm. sort of I think
big time.
Academics are still wrestling with this. I think
German aesthetics is still wrestling
with this. Anyone involved in the Romantics is still having to. This isn't just a German phenomenon. It's something latent in Romanticism itself. I'm not trying to pick on any German listeners, and I'm not trying to say, well, we're above that. No, we're obviously not.
No, and we're about to dive very deep into the Romantic period, actually.
Yeah. So anyway, there's something in a lot of Romanticism that gets taken by fascist ideologies and turned into something that was not the intended thing. The thing that I think makes us uncomfortable in Faust, like you and me, I'm not speaking universally here, is the way that Faust kind of embraces that. Mm-hmm. Right, it's not as latent as we might like, and you know, Thomas Mann wrote Dr. Faustus based on this, really heavily ironizing this particular kind of interpretation of Faust as the quintessential German myth or sort of the quintessential German ideology or something like that. In any case, I think the ironizing, I don't know. I tend to feel like the ironizing was already there in Goethe. That, okay, this is Luke's read on Goethe. Luke claims that Goethe's original design was to have this kind of trial in heaven where, you know, Mephistopheles argues for taking Faust's soul because he's such a damned asshole. And God on the other side is arguing that his constant striving is what saves him. Like even if it gets perverted in the outcome due to diabolical intercession, the impulse is there and the impulse is the thing that saves. All right. Luke's case is that at the end of the day, Goethe took all of that out because he thought it was too explicit, but also it gets at something that we're supposed to be able to take from the text, that the whole thing is ambivalent and equivocal.
Yeah.
That we're meant to feel in some ways ambivalent about Faust. And the fact that his desires and his designs lead him to this destructive place are also the things that's a counterbalance to this drive that he has that ultimately is going to be for the good, even if the outcome is bad.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too.
Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like...
And that's kind of one of the more alien... I don't know. That's a very classical idea right there.
Really. Yeah.
That's an extremely classical concept of this kind of... virtue and worthiness as just being a matter of like drive and ambition, no matter, because, you know, like, I mean, who is the most celebrated figure of the classical era? You know, Alexander the Great, who wreaked untold carnage across an entire continent and his motivation was personal aggrandizement. And everyone was like, oh, well, yeah, of course it was. What else is there? And I think that's like where like a kind of, you know, that's a classical element that actually kind of persists, I guess, in this, you know, maybe that's part of the, you know, the classical that actually is able to be married to this conception of German Protestantism. I'm not sure how successfully it manages to be done.
Well, okay. So the part that makes me want to slap him so bad is outside of the palace, Faust, blinded, is directing Mephistopheles and a bunch of demons. And he's telling them, dig here, do this, do this, do this. And they're digging and digging and digging. But what he doesn't realize is that they're digging his grave.
Yeah.
So, you know, ironies compounded on ironies. But Faust has this thing. All right, I'm sorry. If we survive all this, we're recording in the middle of a pandemic. And a particular feature of the United States in this pandemic is for people, for political reasons, to basically say that they don't want to take safety precautions and live with the greatest amount of risk possible, risking not only their lives, but the lives of others in this extraordinarily selfish gesture, which is, I guess, read as freedom to their limited and stupid minds. Faust makes the same case.
Yeah.
A swamp surrounds the mountain's base. It poisons all I have achieved till now. I'll drain it too. That rotten place shall be my last great project. I see how to give those millions a new living space. They'll not be safe, but active, free at last. My risk is my freedom.
Yeah.
Give me a fucking tower right now. I'm sorry. I don't know. It was one of those moments where if we weren't living at the time in which we were living, perhaps I wouldn't have been as feisty, but I want to live in constant danger all the time because only in constant risk will I feel the true liberation. Oh, give me a goddamn break.
And not only that, but also you're going to have to also for my own hangups.
Yeah. So, you know, so Faust is risking nothing, basically. But anyway, he says only that man earns. He goes on. I see green fields so fertile, man and beast at once shall settle the new pleasant earth, bastioned by great embankments that will rise about them by bold labor brought to birth. Here there shall be an inland paradise. Outside, the sea, as high as it can reach, may rage and gnaw, and yet a common will, should it intrude, will act to close the breach. Yes, to this vision I am wedded still, and this, as wisdom's final word, I teach. Only that man earns freedom, merits life, who must reconquer both in constant daily strife. I mean, this is where we're getting into that fascism.
I was going to say, this is a very Arbeit macht frei kind of ethos here.
Well, I mean, it's hard in the 21st century not to read it that way.
Yeah.
And it's hard in 21st century America not to read it in this kind of stupid authoritarian, my freedom for your life kind of way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But if this recording is anything, it's a snapshot in time of our feelings about this thing. And yeah. One of the things that we set out to do was record our affective responses. And this is my affective response.
Yeah.
Well, what a piece of shit. In such a place, by danger still surrounded, youth, manhood, age, their brave new world have founded. I long to see that multitude and stand with the free people on free land. Then to the moment I might say, beautiful moment, do not pass away. Till many ages shall have passed, this record of my earthly life shall last. And in anticipation of such bliss, what moment could give me greater joy than this? And then he dies. This is... I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to read this completely as Faust reaching his culminating moment.
Yeah.
I think he had better ones earlier, to be honest. There's a kind of legalistic...
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, like, something that kind of is hitting me, like, listening to you read it. Like, and again, this is an artifact of me reading it in 2020, knowing what I know about what was going to happen in the future of Goethe's Germany, but it almost has a touch of the kind of incipient German nationalism, which was just beginning to kind of percolate among the bourgeois and the educated classes at the time. Because something you need to remember is that in the 19th century, nationalism was a project of overeducated people with a lot of time on their hands. There's no such thing as an organic nation that a nation state is an expression of. Every nation state is constructed by bourgeois busybodies. Sorry to ruin everyone's fun. There's no such thing as a folk. It's a construct. Get over it.
Yeah.
But to say that. Yeah. But this
I'm sorry. Like it's that trope of real America that precisely. Always pisses me off so much. Yeah. There are more people on my block than there are in Wyoming. And for some reason, we're not legitimately national or don't have the same kind of rights as a state made up mostly of land and not people. But be that as it may.
Yes, yes. But all that to say, like the notion of like Faust is here. He's literally building a land for the millions. That just strikes me as a very kind of the it's in with the rhetoric that would emerge in nationalism, which of course kind of all exploded in the 1848 revolutions.
Right.
And which are a fascinating sort of phenomenon there because like, as I've kind of talked about, like, you know, nationalism is a bourgeois project. It of course became a focus of reactionary energy afterward, but in the early 19th century, it was also kind of, you would lump it in on the left wing side of things because it meant taking nations away from being the private property of monarchs.
Right.
It really is a matter of like it sort of became entwined with what we would consider quote unquote left wing causes and energies because it was like, no, we are, especially with like, you know, say the Hungarian national movement, like, but we are the Hungarian people, not subjects of the Habsburgs, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very weird time. but I really all that kind of that particular Faust speech really says to me this kind of like, well, what is, well, maybe this is a real, maybe this is a transcendent desire that he had. Mm. Maybe I got it all wrong. I'm discovering this as I say it, but maybe I got it all wrong.
Yeah.
That he's stepping back and like, this is something more mundane than chasing after the eternal feminine in Helen or whatever. Instead, it's a, again, kind of, you know, misogynistic attitude of founding and forging this nationhood, this place, you know, transforming nature as you see it into the crucible of a folk, you know, and where they can live their Lebensraum, if you will.
Right. And the other side of this, Luke does make a case that you can read this as, it's broad enough and symbolic enough that you can read it as totalitarianism. Like, you could read it as fascist, you could read it as sort of Soviet style totalitarianism, you could read it as a variety of different kinds of totalizing systems. Mm-hmm. To view the human as a sort of closed circuit, to be forced in a particular way into, you know, a particular vision of freedom, right? And I think that's also the kind of irony here. Faust's tyranny is for the sake of freedom.
Yeah.
And we've seen the result of that. Like, this old couple who, you know, works hard on us to develop a sense of pathos, well, they're murdered.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Faust just goes on. So, like,
right. I'm with you. Like, I think Goethe is very ambivalent about it. You know,
yeah,
he's absolutely, Goethe himself is ambivalent about it.
It
became clear to me that Faust, the character Faust, is much less ambivalent about it. And he is kind of foreshadowing, you know, your kind of your Otto von Bismarck to come later in the century.
So in any case, he dies, and the language is equivocal, because it suggests possibly that he's reached his apotheosis, but he reaches his apotheosis in eternal striving, mm-hmm. which means he will never reach his apotheosis, which is that sort of paradox that we got to back when we were analyzing the wager in the first place.
Yeah.
So he falls over dead. And Mephistopheles and the demons all sort of have to watch, like, they guard his body because they're waiting for his soul to come out. It might come out through his nose. It might come out through his mouth. Watch his navel and his asshole, because he might have to fart it out. It goes from, you know, this kind of weird, darkly ironic pseudo-fascist thing to like the lowest comedy. And then the choir of angels appears and they start raining rosebuds down on the demons, and it burns the devils. And Mephistopheles is so overcome by the beauty of these heavenly boys. They turn around and show their asses, and he's so taken aback in his own erotic frenzy that they manage to sneak in and steal Faust's soul. All right. That's what saved this act for me.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous. It's so absurd. And the joke in here is that there's a suggestion that even the devil can be saved by beauty. Satan himself might actually be able to be transformed through this kind of erotic potential. And it's just silly beyond all belief. I mean, that ending is so spectacularly bizarre.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, when you're reading Acts 4 and 5, they are so extraordinarily straightforward in this roundabout way. But then we're back to that good old phantasmagoria that Goethe could do so well. And it's like, all right, buddy, here we go. This is what I came for. You know?
That's so right. Yeah.
It's just fantastically weird, and it shouldn't work. The mix of tones shouldn't work. the body and the genuine shouldn't work together, and yet it's so outrageous that it really does. And it's a last little bit of fun before we get some half-baked Dante thrown in there.
Right.
I'm being mean. The whole last part takes place in a kind of mountain gorge with these heavenly speaking voices. And so you have these masculine speaking voices and then these feminine speaking voices. And then ultimately, Faust's soul sort of rises upward into the feminine, and it goes uber Catholic, which is really kind of strange. You have this, this sort of Gretchen becomes a kind of Beatrice figure.
Yeah.
And she has been interceding on the part of Faust's soul. She is lumped together with these holy divine penitents, which means that she was saved because she was truly sorry for all the horrible stuff that she did. Faust was saved just because he never gave up. So
it doesn't matter that what you're doing is awful. Buddy, you stuck to your guns. And we admire that here in heaven.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get past the misogyny. It's hard to get past what this means. But the best read on the ending, I think, comes from or not necessarily the best read, but what I thought was sort of like the most fascinating read on the ending was from the interpreted notes in the Norton, which kind of makes this case that it turns back into that metadrama for a bit. Mm-hmm. Like it goes so fully symbolic, and you know, I'm being mean by calling it a half-baked Dante. It's not. It's actually a pretty fascinating ending to read, and I'm sure in the original German it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
I believe Mahler had set pieces of it to music. I think in one of his symphonies he uses parts of the sort of mountain gorges scene. But the notes in the Norton sort of make this case that this could be like one final meta theatrical turn. This gets us back to that kind of weird place where we started. Mm-hmm. And all of the symbolic action and all the symbolic utterances sort of bring to mind the way that this is kind of like a parameter to be filled by the individual experience. Like you read into it and you bring it to life in your own life, like action and doing or making your own metaphors or making your own symbolic structure is out of these kind of universal systems that Goethe seemed to think were there, that, you know, putting it to work for yourself is the way to actualize it.
Yeah.
So these things are always going to be sort of floating around, and it's up to the audience to do it, to make it real in the sense through acting it out, right? Engagement. Yeah. So we're back to that weird metaphysical thing, and I think in that sense, you know, I keep flirting with this idea that you know, I talked about this when we were doing Act One, and I'm sort of bringing us full circle back into it, but it's sort of like David Bowie's Black Star, David Bowie's last album. I know that's kind of like a pop art comparison to this, you know, high art piece. But, you know, the whole point of that album is by the time you hear this, I'll be gone. This is the final action, right?
Yeah.
And there's this way in which it seems suggestive in Faust that the apotheosis of Faust is the apotheosis of Goethe. This is the final action. This is the elevation into the next level. And whatever the next level is something I won't be able to articulate because I won't be here.
Yeah.
But I can at least chart the action, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's Faust.
That's Faust.
No, so you can kind of see why we decided to do Act 4 and 5 together. They flow one right into the other, really. They seemed more of a unit than the rest of Part 2, for sure.
Yeah.
And also we wanted to get it over with.
But there's still some mysteries to me. All right. So First of all, to get back to, I guess, our project, the affective reaction, as much as I really want to slap Faust around by the end of this, I do find this a fascinating work. It's so outrageous. Like, it's so silly and strange and wild and weird all at once that it does draw you to it. I don't feel a kind of kinship to it in the way that I feel to Don Quixote. I would, if I had nothing else to do for the rest of my life, I would read Don Quixote every day.
I think you're right that work drew me into it. That kinship is a good word for it. Like, you know, I felt that with Don Quixote. I felt that with Montaigne especially, which I think probably has the advantage of like being, you know, tossed off ramblings written in a first person. You know, that helps bring it home a little bit. But I mean, I think in a more important way, like the, for whatever reason, like the kind of the priorities at work in Faust are ones that are not mine to the extent that like I would get a lot out of, you know, that's not what I got out of it, but I did get a lot out of it as a window into a kind of set of priorities or preoccupations that aren't my own. And in that, I think it was a very, I'll go ahead and say, I do not regret reading it. I don't know that I'll ever come back to it. I say that I come back to almost everything eventually in a way. how to articulate this? I've been reading this fucking book for a year. Go ahead. I think you have more. You have.
I'm with you on this, that there's a kind of, I can't be in sympathy with so much of the ideas. I can't be in sympathy with so much of what it's trying to advertise. And there's a lot of it that I find kind of alienating. And I think that was there in part one, like that alienation from Faust, the character, from Faust, the project. It was there in part one. I mean, he's an asshole to Gretchen and basically gets away with it all.
Right. Right.
And there's an alienation from him by the end of act five. Like, the only person I really feel in sympathy with is Mephistopheles. I mean, he's at least funny, but I mean, Faust's project is striving above all things. I get what Goethe is trying to say about the animating spirit being primal in some ways, or it's the intention, not the result, you know? But he goes to such lengths to show us the horrible results of the intention. And it's just, would you just give it up, man? You know, like the intention can't over, like the acknowledgement of the intention can't overlook the real horrible stuff that he does. And it's that alienation that I feel throughout. Maybe there was a time where things would have been different, but the ironies are too compounded by the end. I mean, the ironies are compounded in the first part of Faust, and they're even more compounded at the end, where I take me back to Don Quixote, please. we're using sort of points of contact, and we're at the end of what Bloom calls his aristocratic age, or, you know, drawing from his thinkers, you know, Vico and Bruno. You know, this is the aristocratic age.
Yeah.
And you know, looking back, we're at the end of that, and it's, you know, appropriate enough, I think, to look back on where we've come and where we've come from, like what we've covered so far. And of the works that we have covered, I didn't feel this kind of alienation in Dante.
Yeah.
I didn't feel this kind of alienation in Chaucer. In fact, Chaucer felt closer to home in a lot of ways.
Well, I think you say close to home. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps there's enough, we might be getting to like the sort of historical eras which are close enough to our own, mm-hmm. where the balls that are in the air, the things that are in play,
yeah.
are closer to what are in play now. So that
yeah.
there might be it might hit a little more, because like, you know, I can read, you know, we can read Dante and like, I mean, I don't have a dog in the race between Guelphs and Ghibellines. So I just sit back and enjoy, you know, yeah. that Ghibelline fuck is getting his due, you know, in hell. It's just all part of the experience for me. But we might be getting like, you know, and maybe not specifically with Faust, and maybe we were reading a lot into it, but
yeah.
we might be getting to a stage in literature and, you know, and letters where they're asking and answering questions that are in some respects still being asked and answered today. And so yeah. it's going to be a little more prickly. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. If I could spend time with any of these works again, it would be Don Quixote.
Yeah.
Because that one felt so contemporary. How do you live in a situation where your political system might be trying to kill you and your neighbors also might be trying to kill you?
Yes.
That hit a little too close to home. But it was also such a benevolent work, like for the most, it's mm-hmm. kind-hearted in its own weird way.
Yeah, it clearly had a very kind regard for humanity, and even the humanity of the, well, of course, it had a very kind regard for the most oafish character of all, which was, of course, Don Quixote himself. Well, I say oafish, but I mean, you know, clearly there were more, you know. Anyway, I guess what I mean to say is like, yeah, like Cervantes seemed much more interested in extending where's my perspicacity gone? I'm with you on Don Quixote being a much more humane work, right? Like there's much less anyone in Don Quixote who is striving to achieve and whatever. And is trampling other people to do it is very clearly painted as an asshole who's just hurting people. It's not this ambivalent relationship to it the way it is in Goethe, and an ambivalent relationship in Goethe, which you know we see developing throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. You know, with your, you know, well, it's almost, well, Faust is almost what a Nietzschean Superman, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we all know how, you know, I mean, I do think there is much in Nietzsche that is interesting, but I think, you know, I tend to, find myself a little repulsed, mm-hmm. by the concepts. And, you know, yeah, like even in the more sort of openly aristocratic age of
right.
Cervantes or Chaucer.
Or Montaigne,
right. And who was himself, you know, an aristocrat. All these people were, you know, either aristocrat themselves or rubbed shoulders in that milieu. And maybe it is because the aristocracy was there and more or less accepted that it wasn't something up for grabs, that you didn't have the same kind of like exploration of the will to dominate, because there were just people who dominated.
Right.
They didn't get there by wanting to. They didn't get there by desiring to dominate over all else. They got there because they were born to it.
Right.
But instead, in the 19th century, in this, you know, the 18th and 19th centuries, this kind of opening up, this kind of the liberal revolutions that are occurring, the, you know, the so-called sort of like leveling the playing field for men of European extraction.
Right.
All of a sudden, if, and you don't get rid of hierarchy at the same time, than, which is where I'm kind of sympathetic to the anarchists of the 19th century, because they kind of saw that, like, well, all you're doing is creating this fucking viper pit.
So, like, the will to power of the bourgeoisie,
you
know, which I think describes the last 4 years in America.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think you're right, or that seems a plausible enough suggestion. I mean, I keep thinking back, how do we look back on what we did over the past couple of years? And and all right, this is really stupid, admittedly. But I once asked, I had a professor I really, you know, loved and respected in undergrad, and he was, you know, kind of an academic diva. But I asked him one time, you know, how do you know that a work that you're reading is good? Mm-hmm. You know, and he said, well, think about it like this. You can talk about a play or a poem or a novel or a story. Like you talk about a friend, you talk about the qualities that you like that make you want to spend time with that person.
Yeah.
And it's not at all an academic way of thinking about this kind of reading. And I would never say this in a class that I was teaching, but I do kind of think about that. What makes me want to spend time with any of these works?
Which of these works are a good hang?
Yeah, and I keep coming back. I will probably read Dante again at some point I'm going to have to. But I really look forward to getting back to Montaigne and Cervantes. Of all the things that we've read, and I'm trying to articulate why that is. Like, with Montaigne, I feel like a very interesting person is just telling me their views of the world that they both do and do not take seriously. And it's such a lighthearted, almost conversation that it seems like a friendship, or it seems like a camaraderie. With Don Quixote, there's something of the same going on. It's a kind of play of friendship between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Mm-hmm. And then all the other wild characters that they meet therein. And Don Quixote's world seems so close to ours. There's something about it that seems like this is now that I think draws me to it. I'm not quite sure what that is. I'm not quite sure what qualities those are. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's living in a world that, you know, looks and feels like a hellscape 90% of the time.
Well, you know, it's I found myself thinking along similar lines lately. Here's a little window into my life, everybody. I've been going through a bit of a Steely Dan phase, and which has been a part of my life. I will say I was as a 15-year-old, I listened to Asia on my Discman on the bus, and desperately hoping that nobody could hear the saxophone solos and everything, because it was so lame, but God, it's so good. Anyway, but I found myself wondering, like, okay, like this, you know, the sort of the music that I like, the music that I like to spend time with, the music that's a good hang, you know. Walter mm-hmm. and Donald are there, and Steely Dan. They're making the smooth shit. I love it. Plug me right in. I'm with it. And it's like, well, yeah, but also, like, what is the connecting strand in my brain connecting Steely Dan and, like, Crass, you know, or like Misfits or something? Yeah. Well, I guess Misfits, they're poppy though. They have that. But I mean, like, you know, because I do enjoy a lot of, like, very abrasive hardcore. And also just like the smoothest, like easy listening sounding shit you've ever heard in your life, if you're not listening closely, because Steely Dan is actually very sophisticated and great. But like, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that. Like, what are the through lines? What do these things have in common other than that they're tickling my brain in a certain way? And why is that the only commonality they have? It would seem that
sometimes
they must have
all they need.
There must be something that's going on to elicit a similar reaction. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe I need to, I don't know. I'll read up on Descartes and Locke and all those idiots about sensory impressions. Who knows?
Who knows? I don't think you really need to. But anyway, I guess we've done with the aristocratic era, except for Shakespeare. And I think our plan is to come back to Shakespeare at a later date.
Yeah,
he's, just because that seems like a project unto itself.
He is one kettle of fish, that guy.
Yeah. So what we're going to do next is, well, all right. Bloom moves into what he calls the democratic age, and that's sort of inaugurated with British Romanticism. And so he gives us a chunk of Wordsworth and a chunk of Jane Austen. So what Daniel and I decided to do was, instead of just reading one poem by Wordsworth, because who wants to do that? Mm-hmm. We're going to take on the lyrical ballads. The lyrical ballads really were a kind of watershed event in English publication. And it allows us to kind of look back to the 18th century and think about how the 18th century became the 19th century.
Yeah.
How, you know, socially, culturally, and politically,
yeah,
the sort of Augustan age became the Romantic age, mm-hmm, and how we move from the kind of heroic couplets that Pope and Johnson, you know, so admired, to something a lot looser. And on the one hand, lyrical ballads is this watershed moment. On the other hand, it really does draw from a lot of what was going on in terms of working class writing in the later part of the 18th century. So what we're going to do next time is begin lyrical ballads, not with lyrical ballads, but with the background information on the age, the era, and the two contributors to the lyrical ballads, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So I think next episode is going to be information heavy, and then we're going to read the 1798 lyrical ballads, and after that, the 1800 lyrical ballads.
Yeah.
So there are two publications of lyrical ballads, and they're both different. They're expanded, switched around, things get weird. Anyway, that's our plan. 1798 and then the 1800. Okay. So I think that's it.
Yeah.
Rate and review on iTunes. check us out at The Cannonball Pod, is it?
Yes. On Twitter at The Cannonball, at Cannonball Pod. Or just, I think if you search for Cannonball, you know, we should show up there. But yeah, at Cannonball Pod.
Yeah, interact with us on Facebook if you like. And you can find more information online at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. So, enjoy. Hope you had fun. And I'm going to put Goethe away for a long, long time.
Well, set Goethe down, and I'm going to read something really brainless that I can just inhale just as a change of pace.
All right. And good night.
Good night.